Get ready to get your nerd on.
Kick the week off right with games, gadgets, and general geekery from the ladies of the Electric Sisterhood on the Eshcast.
On Tuesday, the J-pop and alternative hotspot hits your eardrums on No Borders, No Race.
Geek Aggro is coming at you on Wednesdays to fill what's left of your cerebral cortex with the hottest beats to get you on your feet.
Then you have me, Phil the Issues Guy, with the live issues program's post-episode recaps on live right after your favorite shows and taking all of your questions.
It's going down each week, only in the land of Esh. Nerdcore at its finest.
Konnichiwa, my bastards and wenches, and welcome to another episode of No Borders, No Race. I am your king, Bibidakev and Borgo. So 2 weeks ago, I talked about this manga series by author Junko called Kiss Him, Not Me. A great series, by the way, and if you haven't read it yet, you can find it on Crunchyroll Manga and in print via Kodansha USA. Anyways, I talked about how there was going to be an announcement in the next chapter, and I said it would be really awesome if it was like an anime adaptation. Well, turns out my wish came true. So yeah, we're totally getting an anime adaptation of Kiss Him, Not Me. Now, I'm not sure when it's going to air, but Brainsbase, the same folks behind the anime versions of Blood Lad, Princess Jellyfish, and Aoharu X Machine Gun, will be producing it with some pretty talented people helping out behind the scenes. Now, I'm just crossing my fingers that they are going to get some great singing to voice the characters. And I've heard a bit of the drama CD that was released last year and thought those were great choices. I mean, maybe they'll get some of those people involved, maybe not. But I'm just so excited about the news, and I hope that you are too. In fact, as of this recording, today, they showed off a picture of what the characters are going to look like in anime form, and they look great. So hopefully when it becomes animated, it'll also look great. Seriously, I am just so stoked that we're getting an anime version of Kiss Him, Not Me. This is the first time I've actually been reading a manga before an anime version had come out. So just imagine just how happy I am that this news is just actually true. So yeah, Kiss Him, Not Me, anime version. Hopefully coming out maybe either summer or fall of this year. And crossing my fingers, too, that it gets licensed in some way, shape, or form. We've got a lot of show to cover, so let's move on. Let's get things rolling. Let's get this playlist started. Remember, as always, if you like what you hear and want to support these artists, you can grab just about all these records on cdjapan.co.jp, amazon.com, iTunes, Bandcamp, the band's official sites, and your local record store. We're going to start things off with the musician Sayuri, an amazing up-and-comer whom I think is going to make waves in the Japanese pop scene. This is the title track from her latest mini-album and also serves as the ending theme to the anime Erased. If you haven't started watching it, what the hell is wrong with you? One of the best-written shows on Crunchyroll at this very moment. You can also watch it on Hulu and Funimation. Here now is Sayori with Sore wa Chisana Hikari no Yuna.
Boku dake ga mite ta kimi no koto kakko mo mirai mo kanashimi mo yorokobi mo subete otora ni naru de kitto yasashiku Kodomo no koro no boku no
I'm a Mr. D.
their Space Vacation album, that was P-Lander Z with Mr. T. P-Lander Z are the subject of a brand new documentary called Mad Tiger, which is currently on the film festival circuit. You know, wouldn't it be cool if I could have the directors of Mad Tiger join us for an interview segment? You know what? I think it would be, which is exactly what we're going to do right now. Please welcome the directors of Mad Tiger, John Lee and Michael Hartling.
Hi.
Hey.
How's it going, guys?
Good, good. We're so happy to be here.
Yep. By the way, did I pronounce that right, Mike? Is it Hartline or Hartlang?
Yeah, Hartline. That's right.
Hartline.
Yeah,
Hartline. And it's spelled as wrong as possible. And yeah. Actually, I'm John Yee, by the way, not John Lee. But
No,
John
I did Lee say is, Yee. Oh, I did say Yee. I swear, I said Yee. It was totally Yee. But
thank you for having us.
No, not a problem. Before we were doing the interview, I was talking to Mike both of you guys, about how I was at the film festival. That's how I got to meet Mike over at the Salem Film Festival. We premiered Mad Tiger in the New England area, and I thought you guys did a great job with the portrayal of the band and the spirit of what P-Lander Z is all about.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, we began as fans of the band, so, you know, we approached them with a lot of reverence and respect.
So how were you two first introduced to P-Lander Z in the first place?
The first time I heard of P-Lander Z, classmate of mine from college named Kenji Hayasaki, he introduced me to P-Lander Z because he had worked alongside Yellow just in Japanese production and things, and they had worked together, and he was like, oh, this guy I know is in this crazy punk band, you love punk rock, you would love them. So I reluctantly went with him, and I was so blown away. This was actually right at the moment that Blue had left and Green had stepped in as a drummer. I immediately told all my friends to start seeing their shows. Michael, of course, came with me to some of those shows as well. I started directing music videos for them. I did So Many Mike, and then I did a few of the karaoke videos. And then, you know, it was always something that we wanted to do a documentary about, but there was no active story at the time, up until Red was leaving the band, and we decided to start filming a documentary based around that story.
Mike, what was your first interaction with P-Lander Z?
Well, you know, my first P-Lander Z show was around the same time John first came in contact with them. And at that show, Green was able to hang upside down playing the drums while Red was hanging upside down playing the bass. And I'd been going to punk shows regularly since I was 9 years old, and I had never seen anything like that ever. And that made a very strong impression on me. And then because Kengo has a tour van, which he will drive and rent out, John and I began hiring him to drive on productions for us. So he also became somebody we developed a relationship with to work in production as well, which was a very interesting way to get to know somebody. And he was very professional and very serious, which is, you know, not how he conducts himself on stage. But it was something that I was able to kind of respect his approach to everything. And I could tell that he takes the stage act very seriously because he, you know, that's how he approaches everything in his life.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to truly explain, but people will go to a P-Lander Z show and it's something like the most craziest stuff that they'll ever see. But people don't realize how much hard work it is to create that sort of craziness onto the stage. It's not like it's totally improvised. What P-Lander Yellow or Kengo, or however you want to call him, is able to do, it's crazy. He like directs these sorts of like mad creations live on stage every single night, and he brings forth just some of the most imaginative punk rock shows you can ever fathom, and it's just amazing to see them live, to put it bluntly.
Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
I want to say, you know, Yellow says that what he does is theater. And so I think that's a great comparison. But it's also, in a way, it's like conducting an orchestra. You know, he is conducting the energy in the room. And through the theater of P-Lander Z performance, I mean, he is truly using call and response art to kind of drive up this really manic joy and kind of try to make everyone happy, and that's what a P-Lander Z show is. I think, you know, it's as Yellow will say, it's 90% theater and 10% music.
It took us a while to figure out that Yellow was truly the conductor of every aspect of the show. You know, thought in every band there's a leader, but the extent at which he controlled the vision of P-Lander Z and how much that was Yellow's brainchild was something that we really started to fully grasp as we got to know him. And that was originally one of the hurdles that we needed to gain his trust with, because as a background as a painter and then as an artist in P-Lander Z, he's so used to having complete creative control, in a way that letting go of that even a little bit, it was really difficult for him. So we were really appreciative that he was eventually able to let go and help let us make the film.
Was there ever a time when you were still trying to think of this movie that the idea of like a mockumentary ever came up?
Well, he brought that up.
Yeah, you know, Kengo Yellow, this was the first time the band had ever been filmed out of costume. And so, you know, there is, I would say it was difficult for them to not make a story that's a total fantasy, the way P-Lander Z is, approaches everything as a fantasy. And for John and I think from the very beginning, we only wanted to make this movie if it was honest and it was and it had the truth. And so, you know, I do think Yellow was ready for that, although I think he very often really wanted to include the fantasy of P-Lander Z alongside the truth. But I think the film Mad Tiger is, you know, it's an honest story. And I think it shows what the role of fantasy is with P-Lander Yellow and how important that is to him.
We tried to show that too, I think, in the car when he was telling us. And there's a scene in the film where he tells us not to portray a scene, and he wanted to re-portray that scene for us in sketches in a more fun way. And we left that in the film just to show that he was having a hard time with dealing with the reality of the situation.
And you know, you can totally understand is how he feels, because it's frustrating, because while you were making Mad Tiger, it was, you know, you had initially started doing this because, you know, P-Lander Red was about to leave. And then it was announced that P-Lander Green, who some people may also know him as Akihiko Naruse at the Portugal Japan, he would be departing as well. So with all these members of P-Lander Z leaving the band, do you feel that in essence changed the tone of the documentary even more so?
Well, we had a sense that was something, big changes were going to happen, because you could just feel it, I think, in the air a little bit. Originally, we were going to film only for a few days about Red's last show and have Red as the main character of the film. And our editor, Hisayo Kushida, she is, you know, always looking at our footage and told us that the story really here is Yellow's story. It's not really Red's story. So we continued to film, and we could feel that this was a story worth following. And I think Michael has worked a lot with nonfiction programming as well, and I think my experience in that field as well, we just knew together that there was something brewing, a lot of changes to come, whatever they might be.
I would say that transition of any kind is when you see what somebody's made of, and that is the most revealing time for someone's character. And so when Red decided to quit, there was no question that the entire band was going to transform. And it certainly did transform quite a bit. And that was going to reveal what was inside Yellow. And I think that's what we knew. Also, I lost my train of thought. But, you know, that's something that we just wanted to show up and try to portray in an honest way as possible.
I think you always know when something has to happen. I mean, this is a huge upheaval in Yellow's life. It was a huge upheaval to lose Red. I mean, Red was the focus of that band towards the end. As if you were a P-Lander Z fan, it's hard to imagine somebody stepping into those shoes at that point. So even just that, without Green leaving the band, just moving on with another Red, it's almost like seeing somebody go through a divorce and try to start dating again and using Tinder or something. Like, what's that's like? You know, like, he's been out of the game for so long of finding a creative partner, that I think that was interesting.
And I think they brought that up, or rather, you guys brought it up very well when you're showing Kengo painting the van. And he makes mention that P-Lander Yellow is yellow with just a little bit of red. And for me, that showed like how hard he was trying to adjust to the recent changes in the group. Because he feels like he needed a little bit more of P-Lander Red before it was time for him to really move on to the next phase of P-Lander Z.
Yeah, there's a great deal of symbolism with the color. I mean, that's something, you know, in the movie you could explore endlessly. You know, if you just focused on the role of color in the film, you know, I'm not going to go on about it here. But, you know, there is both red and yellow are very attached to their colors. And I would say still today. And the colors hold a lot of meaning for them. And so, yeah, there's a few different points at which you see a little bit of red mixed in with yellow, whether it's paint or hair dye. And that's how Kengo defines P-Lander yellow, is yellow with a little bit of red. And so, you know, that's it, in the way that, you know, he turned red white at Red's last show in order to make him reborn into Kotaro Tsukada.
Yep.
There's a lot to be said for the symbolism of color in Mad Tiger.
Now, was there anything, besides all this stuff, was there anything about the band members, too, that surprised you as you were recording?
Yeah, I think we were surprised a lot in a lot of steps of the way. Originally, when we started filming, it was 100% a blast for me and Michael. You know, hanging out with these guys was just 100% pure fun. And it took us a while to realize that that was a facade that they were putting on for us, kind of performing for us, because we were guests at that point. Once we started filming more regularly, we started to see cracks in that fantasy that they were presenting to us. And I think we eventually saw that their relationships were really strained. And I think seeing that they were a normal group of people, a normal band with normal relationship issues, it was kind of shocking for us to see that side of it. And we were worried when we were making the film when we finished the film, that fans like you, for example, P-Lander Z fans, might be reluctant or shocked by this. Or on the other hand, it's nice to see behind the curtain finally after all these years. It could have gone either way. So I'm glad that you were able to appreciate that, because it could have gone in a way that people want to maintain that fantasy.
Absolutely. And I always knew that there was always the, you know, the reality and the fantasy sort of thing. But at the same time, just to actually see it right there on the big screen, you know, it takes a little bit for you to get used to. But at the same time, you've got to realize that this happens practically with every single music act on the planet. Whether you're P-Lander Z, or if you're someone like, even like, let me throw names out there, like the Decemberists, or even like Aerosmith. There's always going to be some sort of strain and tension between band members. And even though they're friends, you know, there's some times where they need to step away and get some air, as it were.
Yeah, and I would add that I think this happens in every relationship, whether it's a friendship, a marriage, you know, any kind of partnership, especially creative partnerships. So, you know, hopefully this is something that people, even with no exposure to bands or being in a band, you know, can relate to on a personal level. I think we've all had personal relationships that, you know, get strained, but also in some ways we need these people to complete part of ourselves and to move forward. So, you know, it's definitely part of every band, but I also think everyone at some point in their life might be able to relate to this.
I actually 100% agree with you right there. I feel like this is a film that, like you said, anybody can learn from this, depending on what sort of relationship, whether it be a friendship or like a partnership, a marriage or something. I feel like this surprisingly captures every single aspect of a relationship in an 80-minute film.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. You know, when we were editing, you know, a lot of times it was funny. John and I noticed that the way we were talking about their relationship was almost the way that we would discuss somebody else's breakup, you know, a boyfriend, girlfriend, or something like that. You know, there's a lot of parallels to other parts of life, for sure.
Yeah, it was like Purple came in being the new girlfriend, you know.
Yeah.
And when Red goes to see them play, it's almost like Red's eating at the same restaurant that he's out with his new girlfriend, or on his first date with a new girlfriend, right? So, and you're like, why is this person here? There was a lot of parallels like that.
And you could kind of get that, too, when Kengo felt a little bit frustrated seeing Red at the show.
Yeah, it's like you're ruining my first time with this person, right?
I know he probably didn't mean it like that, but that's just kind of like what he was feeling at the time.
You also can't judge, and this is something that didn't make it into the film, but Pilander Green had expressed. There's a lot of great things Pilander Green expressed that was not in the film, which will be on the DVD. But I think he was saying that it's unfair to judge Pilander Purple's first show performance with the last performance of Pilander Red. It took over 10 years to get to that point of Pilander Red being as good as he was as a performer. So to put those two back to back, you know, first show, last show, is completely unfair.
Absolutely. And yeah. I couldn't agree more, because, you know, this is Pilander Purple, you know, basically trying it out for the first time. And, you know, from the footage that I've seen, and I've seen, you know, not just your footage, but footage that I've watched on, like, YouTube and such, I thought he did a pretty good job for his first time as a Pilander member.
And he's an incredible bass player. I mean, he's sponsored by ESP. He was in several bands that were pretty successful in Japan. He walked away from a lot of things to join Pilander Z, and he will continue to grow into that kind of role. But I think, your first show is your first show, right?
Right.
So you can't judge everything by that. But I think for Yellow, it's been a long time since he's had a first show with somebody at that point. That was the first time in years he's had a first show with somebody.
If you don't mind if I make a bit of a comparison too, it was like when I was watching the footage of Pilander Purple playing for the first time, you know, in practice, it reminded me of when you saw in the movie Metallica, Some Kind of Monster, when Robbie first came in to take over from Jason Newsted. And I'm not just talking about just that happening. I'm even talking about the play style too. He's got that sort of Robbie bass stance while he's playing the bass with Pilander Yellow and Pilander Green.
Yeah, he's a finger player, you know, versus Red's pick playing. It's a stylistically radically different. The proficiency is super different. The songs sound different. And I just love the enthusiasm of Purple coming in the film. He's a very popular character. We've noticed, Michael and I have noticed that a lot of people around us really like Purple's character because he's excited to be there. And he's incredibly insightful at the end of the film.
You know, I would also add that I believe Purple embodies the Pilander Z ethos, you know, at the point we were filming, more than anybody else in the movie. You know, I think that Purple's enthusiasm and his commitment to spreading happiness is, in a way, untainted by any other concerns. Mm-hmm. And so I believe he is a true Pilander Z member. You know, he just had to kind of perfect his stagecraft.
Right, right. And I know that that's going to be worked on as it goes along because, as you know, not to spoil too much of the film, but there is a part where you kind of see Pilander Purple go back to Japan, but he is going to be returning sometime soon.
He is coming. He actually just landed in Long Island City yesterday. So he is
really
going to be able to do this. Yeah, he's going to be able to do, I think, the full tour with him this spring. He did not do the last tour. Pilander Pink actually started learning bass, and she did the tour last tour. But Purple will be joining them for this leg of it, the next couple months.
That's terrific. And I know, and Mike, I know you mentioned a little bit about this, but he and Kengo are planning to relocate from New York, correct?
Yeah, that's something that, you know, they've been discussing for a while, and you know, as plans go, they can always change. So it hasn't happened yet, but you know, I guess we'll have to see. But that is something that they've been discussing.
At least Yellow is going to be relocating in June of this year to Austin. That is his plan. So after the tour ends in May, he'll pack up for a month in New York and then head out to Austin, where he's going to be able to pursue the painting aspect of his career as well, which is really taking off. And he's been doing so much down there with painting, it totally makes sense for him to go down.
And I've seen a lot of his works, you know, outside of like Pilander Z, and he is incredibly talented. And what I found a little bit like disheartening was you guys were talking about, he was talking about this like art exhibition that he held where he basically took all of his art and just painted it all white. And,
right.
And I can't picture any artist doing something like that. It just, that sounds soul crushing to me.
Yeah. It's an act of violence. I mean, it was, you know, it's self-destructive to do that. But I think that is how he created Pilander Yellow afterwards. You know, is he had to just completely obliterate his former life. But, you know, there's an interesting parallel to him kind of ending his painting career by painting it all white, and by him liberating red by turning him white as well.
I never thought of that. Wow, that's crazy.
Which also later on, when Red asks for permission to stay red a little longer, I think that was something that Red had thought was like something given to him by Yellow, his colors, and he was still wanting to wear those colors. So having to ask permission is such a crazy thing for us, but in their world, it makes total sense that Red was asking to continue to be red.
Right. And I can kind of understand why. Now, you, all of you, you two, Kengo, Kotaro, you recently took part in a recording of a commentary track for this film, and I'm curious, how did that go?
I think it went really well. I think it's really interesting. It's totally crazy. I mean, Yellow is Yellow in it, but I think you should just listen to it. I think I haven't listened to it since it happened. So it was just kind of going in and out. Watching the movie with them in the room is a really weird experience. So I think if you want to have that weird experience, check it out. I'm curious too, to listen back to it.
Yeah. As I remember, it's there's not a lot of kind of secret behind the scenes information revealed. It's more like hanging out with Red and Yellow together and kind of experiencing that crazy ride. So, you know, it should be fun for any fan to listen to. I mean, it was fun to sit through. It was definitely, it felt like at the end I survived it, you know. So
yeah, and the engineer was dying. I remember seeing an engineer who was recording it behind the glass, and he was just at times just cracking up so bad. So yeah, that's a good sign at least.
It's almost as if you had passed Pilander Yellow's test.
I hope so.
Can anyone pass his test? I don't know if anyone really can.
Yeah.
Yeah, which he does make mention of in the film.
It's very hard. Nobody passed.
Yeah. Now, I take it that with the two of them in the same room, that Kengo and Kotaro's relationship, their friendship, isn't as tense as it once was, correct?
It's not tense anymore. I mean, they've grown to become friends. Of course, they were always best friends in that sort of way. They need each other, but it's a different relationship now when you don't need each other for day-to-day tasks. It totally changes the nature of your friendships with people when you don't need them in that business capacity. It's kind of confusing as to how this person, it fits into my life when that part of our relationship is over, but they are on good terms now.
And that's good to hear, because I'm sure some fans out there may be concerned, but to hear that they're friends, I think that'll make a lot of them happy. Now,
yeah, I actually think it's helpful to their relationship to not have the band business kind of in the way. You know?
Absolutely. Now, what do you hope viewers will learn from watching Mad Tagger, be it longtime fans of Pilander Z or even newcomers to the band who have never even heard of Pilander Z?
I would say, I hope that fans of Pilander Z... So in the beginning of the movie, Yellow sits down, he's in full costume, and he's in total character as Pilander Yellow. And by the end of the film, hopefully the audience gets close enough to him that they don't even notice his crazy hair anymore, and they just see a real person. And so I hope that people can walk away from this understanding that the path towards finding happiness is more to do with being good to those you love than trying to manufacture crazy fun. And that's what we tried to show as a turning point with y'all.
Is that a lesson that you also personally learned from making this movie, or was there something far deeper that you two found yourself learning from making the movie?
Well, originally, I think the idea, the germ of the idea of the movie of Red's last show was, how was it going to feel for somebody to walk away from his dream, right? Walking away from your dream of music, walking away from your dream of being a rock star, how does that feel? And that was the idea that originally we wanted to tell that story. And then it morphed into this relationship story which is much more broad and much more real. And I think we learned through that process that it was their story was not this tiny story about wanting to be a rock star, which is related to by very few people, right? I think this is a much more broad thing.
Yeah.
I think we learned a lot throughout making this film in terms of what's making creative decisions in terms of how to gain people's trust, how to not betray people, how to do things in a right way with this film, because we are friends with P-Lander Z. It was a learning experience on so many levels. We've aged a lot, I feel like, through this process of making the film, much more than the 2 years or so that we worked on it in earnest. I think we were there for so much of the heartbreak and everything within the band too. So I think for us, we grew also as people and learned to not be so, I guess, mean to each other or other people as well, and try to be better about just your day-to-day handlings of things. It's really hard because a lot of times, and I was like this a lot too, is usually when you are upset or going through a tough time, the closest people next to you are the ones who suffer the most, because you're in a bad mood, you take it out on whoever's next to you, right? So
Right. This
damages relationships, this damages friendships, which is why bands fall apart, which is why marriages fall apart. And I think making this film taught us that you can't just do that to those people around you. You know, the people who are supporting you, who are closest to you, can't just let your emotions spill out onto everyone in that sort of way.
Yeah, John and I are creative partners in making this movie. And so, you know, we had to draw some lessons from this and how we interacted with each other in terms of not, you know, acting out of mutual respect at all times and not taking our frustrations out on each other, and also serving the creative project over our own egos and that kind of thing.
So in an essence, it taught the two of you to be better people to each other as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Or at least try, right?
At least try.
It's always a work in progress. And I think that was another thing we learned, is you never arrive at, we're always trying to figure out, when do we end this film? When do we end this movie? And, you know, the story of P-Lander Yellow goes on forever. But we decided that, you know, we show that he's taking the steps to become that person that he always said he was. So when you start making the actual steps to become this happy person, that's when he's on his way. Right. But I think it's a lifelong journey in terms of improving yourself.
Yeah, I think it would be dishonest to show somebody arriving at total peace and happiness. You know, I think that we try to just honor what happened in front of us.
Right. You don't want to try to go for the Hollywood ending.
Absolutely not.
Right.
But for a documentary of this sort, it'd be so disingenuous, so dishonest. Right. Mm-hmm. So for us, it was a big deal for us. The end scene of the film, for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's a moment where he just takes a step. Yellow takes a step towards the path that he needs to be going on.
And it's definitely a step towards being, you know, a better person to not just those around him, but even a better person to himself.
Absolutely.
That's a good way of putting it.
Now, currently, Mad Tiger is going around the film festival circuit, but what do you have plans for the movie after that's all finished?
So, we actually are launching our theatrical releases starting on the 20th of March at Alamo Drafthouse in Austin. And then we're hitting a number of cities, which are on our website, madtigermovie.com. If you go there, you can check out if it's going to be in cities near you. If it's not in cities near you, we are going to be partnering with this company called Tug, which you can host screenings in your hometown, which there's already been a lot of interest for. So you can at least be an organizer, organize a screening at your local theater, and even take a percentage of the ticket profits if you want to do something like that. After that's done, we're going to be doing video on demand platforms like iTunes. And those are, you know, pay on demand stuff. And way down the line, maybe next year or something, we're figuring out what kind of free streaming platforms we're going to be on. Our DVD release is also going to be around the same time as VOD, and it's a 2-disc set. And what's really cool about it is we have a full concert movie, second DVD of Red's last show. And it's awesome. We shot it with four cameras and it's like a full professional audio mix, like Red's last show. It is P-Lander Z's best show of all time. So if you were not able to be there, having that DVD is awesome. So.
And props for using Tug. Initially, I was trying to use that to get a screening of the Funimation film Wolf Children to happen around here, but I couldn't get enough interest. But hopefully, my listeners out there will hear this and go visit Tug and help to bring Mad Tiger to their local movie theater.
I think the screening this film in front of a big audience has been really fun. It's been really awesome because it's an audience pleaser. I think Michael was mentioning that it's very rare to go to a movie theater, especially a documentary, and hear people yelling out to the screen because they're excited or anything like that, making noises in the crowd. And I go to see documentaries all the time in the theater and it's dead silent. So I think... Yeah. This is a really good one to watch in the theater. But the DVD will be killer too. I mean, you got the commentary. You also have all those deleted scenes of all of Green's story. Yep. Green's personal story. That's all there. That's really cool stuff. We just couldn't fit it in. Our first edit of this film was over 3 hours long.
Jeez. So, wow.
We just had to change our priorities.
Yeah, we also have a vinyl picture disc soundtrack, which is not of P-Lander Z music, but it's music scored for the film by the band Joy Wants Eternity and Daniel Salo. So that'll be available digitally on iTunes and through a vinyl picture disc limited edition as well.
Yeah, and that vinyl picture disc is already on sale. If you go to our website at madtigermovie.com, it's there. Also, if we're at the screenings, we generally carry some on us. Yeah, and it's a great album, actually. That was actually the thing that Michael and I were most excited about because we were using Joy Wants Eternity's music from before in our temp tracks of our rough cuts. And we were just exploring the opportunity of using those tracks for the movie. Mm-hmm. So I went on Facebook trying to find what their deal was these days. And I saw that their contact email on their Facebook fan page was just one of the band members. So I reached out cold and they decided to actually reunite and write an entire album for us. So that worked out better than ever. And actually, tonight I'm going to hang out with one of those guys at the screening in San Francisco. So
that's fantastic. Yeah. And hey, you brought back one of your favorite bands.
Yeah, it was really cool. And the record is really awesome. Actually, just as a record, it sounds really great. So if you're a fan of like Explosions in the Sky and all that kind of instrumental rock music, really emotional instrumental rock, I think it's really great.
Yeah, it reminded me a bit of This Will Destroy Us and
Mono.
Yeah. And Mono as well. Now, I know you've just finished up with this film, but I'm curious to know if the gears are currently turning for the next film you'd like to work on, or is there another subject of that you guys would like to film for a documentary in the near future?
Are you going to disclose anything? Are you going
to
say?
Well, I honestly, it's probably too early to really talk about. But, you know, I think John and I are always kind of, you know, trying to get our next thing going. So.
Yeah. If I could throw in a suggestion, because they're Mike and I did talk about this band. And initially, they were supposed to have a documentary, but it never came about. Electric Eel Shock.
Yeah. So Electric Eel Shock, those guys are actually, I just was in contact with them today, a few hours ago. They're going to our screening in Osaka tonight, actually, at the Osaka Asian Film Festival. They haven't seen the film. So I'm really curious if they like the film and we can talk afterwards. I know that they were really cool when we were filming and really good about just giving us space to shoot in a tiny cramped van all together, you know, and I think Aki told us, you know, I trust that you guys will make a really great film, just because he could just tell we were so serious about it right at the beginning. But he was really cool and supportive. All those guys were really cool and supportive. Jayan, the drummer, you can make a documentary just on that guy. He's a pastry chef. Do you know that? He's a dentist.
Yeah.
You know, den chef.
Like, I'm Facebook friends with all three of them, so I can tell you. They're a great bunch of people, and I will argue that Giant is probably the best drummer on the planet. I will, hands down, the absolute best.
He's a naked drummer.
Yeah.
Naked drummer, play four sticks at a time. He'll bake you an amazing cake and then make you dinner, Oden dinner. And then if your teeth rot, he can make you new teeth.
He also looks good in hip-hop clothing.
He also has a really weird hip-hop side project where he wears big hammer pants. It's really awesome because he just fully owns whatever he's doing. And I think what I love about them is... And P-Lander Z. And what this is another thing that's... P-Lander Blue's story is on the DVD as well, and unfortunately we couldn't include it. But P-Lander Z's whole thing, which P-Lander Blue learned, is there's nothing more uncool than trying to be cool. And just doing your best at anything and doing 100% at whatever you do, that is the coolest thing. And that was such wisdom coming from P-Lander Blue about what he learned from Yellow and P-Lander Z. And I think Eelshock is the same way. It's 100% what you're doing.
Absolutely. And I'll argue that, like, I've seen Electric Eelshock three times. Twice at the Middle East upstairs in Cambridge and once in Shibuya in Japan, like, almost 9 years ago. And every time that they hit the stage, they put on a stadium-worthy show.
That's right.
Do you remember the artwork for one of their albums? Actually, we were watching them play, and the artwork of one of their LPs was so killer that Michael asked them who did the art, and then the person who did the art for that actually ended up doing the poster art for Mad Tiger as well as the art for the LP.
It was Transcontinental Rock, I think.
Oh, Transworld Ultra Rock.
Yes. So that album cover was, you know, kind of had a 70s action film style to it. And so we asked them who did the painting, and we hired that person to do our poster.
And it's interesting you say that, because I got the album because initially I had pre-ordered the documentary for Sex, Drugs, and Email, which was going to be the Electric Eelshock documentary, and that never came to fruition. And as an apology to those who pre-ordered it, they gave people the new album for free.
I see. Wow.
And it's an awesome album.
This is also why we didn't do a Kickstarter or anything like that. Michael and I are constantly working for clients on these kinds of projects, and we wanted to make a film on our terms in the best way we could and without any outside pressure or interference. So that sort of way, we didn't want to get involved with the Kickstarter campaign, even though this would have been so perfect for one because of P-Lander Z's fans. But I think the smartest thing for us was just to make as good a film as possible without the pressure of needing to please a client or change something for the edit for runtime for television or something like that. So.
Right. And you know what? You two did an amazing job. And thankfully, it came out to be a great movie. And that I highly recommend, even if you're not a fan of P-Lander Z, if you are in a band, if you're in a relationship, this is a type of film where it could teach you about the highs and lows of being in a relationship with someone for a very long time, be it as boyfriend, girlfriend, or even band members, or even best friends.
Or if you're divorced.
That too.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. It really does mean a lot, honestly. And I know that you know P-Lander Z very well, and so the background that you have with them, your opinion matters a lot to us.
Yeah. And you know, the first time I ever met them was at Kaiju Big Battle TV pilot shooting at the old Avalon in Boston, and meeting all the band members.
So do you know Randy?
Randy, the guy who... I've never met Randy, but I am good friends with the person who created the P-Lander Yellow Puppet.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So if you're interested in Kaiju Big Battle, and if you want to describe Kaiju Big Battle for people who don't know, there's a lot of stuff on the bonus DVD of that guy, Randy, who is behind Kaiju as well.
Yes.
Of making the costumes and everything. But Kaiju is like... wrestling with monsters?
It's pro wrestling with Japanese monsters. It's the most simplest thing that you can say about it, and people will go, oh, so it's like watching Godzilla live on stage. I'm like, yes, it's exactly like that.
And it's hilarious.
Oh, no, I can vouch it. It's highly entertaining.
Some of my favorite stuff that we had filmed was of Randy and the Kaiju guys getting ready for Purple's entry into the world, and unfortunately didn't make it into the film, but it is on the DVD. So usually I wouldn't push DVDs on people so hard because I've just like watch it streaming or whatever, but there's just so much that I wish that people could have seen that I think at this point in time that's the only way we were able to get it out to people eventually.
Well, I can't wait for the release of it on DVD. I'm sure our listeners who may not be able to see it in theaters will look very much forward to seeing the film on home video pretty soon. So, John, Michael, thank you so much for joining me here on No Borders, No Race. You said MadTigerMovie.com is the best place for people to find more info, correct?
That's correct.
Right. All right. So, yes, visit that. Like their Facebook page. Be sure to like P-Lander Z as well, and be sure to also like the band that I'm going to play next. They are close friends with P-Lander Z, known as Math the Band. And John, you were telling me that you actually filmed one of my favorite music videos of theirs.
Yep, 4 to 6 is the video I did with Math the Band, and it's where a guy's head explodes full of spaghetti. So, yep. Good for that.
Yes, and that made me a super fan of the band. And Math the Band have formed a new group recently called Math the Band the Band, and with that they released an album called Math the Band the Band the Album, and this is a cut from that album, and it's called Why Didn't You Get a Haircut?
Good enough, is it?
from their 2006 album Royal Blood that was gaga-like with Little Giant on my shoulder. I had the privilege of meeting Maimu a few years ago at Anime Boston 2010, sitting down for an interview with her for our earlier one-on-one show that also featured J. Michael Tatum and Dick Tripwire. And joining us right now are our good buddies Andrew and Jonathan Fleming from Wicked Anime.
Yo!
Hello!
Hello! And this week we are talking about The Boy and the Beast, the new film from one of our favorite directors, Mr. Mamoru Hosoda.
Not one of our favorite directors, at least for me.
Yeah.
My favorite director.
Yeah. He has quickly become my absolute favorite anime director as well, because it's hard to really truly understand what the statement is that I'm going to make, but he has the ability to capture like this real human emotion in animated form in such a way that even live action or even like Pixar movies can't seem to grasp.
Yeah. And you actually said a key word, and you said anime director, and you misheard me. I said director. He's my favorite director. Period.
Director.
Yep.
Wow.
Even over like animation and all that stuff, he is my favorite director.
Oh, wow. So even over the likes of like Spielberg and Quentin Tarantino, even over those people.
This guy, like, you know, he has creative control over his stories. Like, he wrote these stories and he gets to direct them, and he's on animation direction because of his expertise in the anime industry as a whole. So yeah, he's my favorite director. He constantly makes just great product.
And I couldn't agree more. And what's so special about us and Mamoru Hosoda, and sadly one of our other friends who was going to join us, a 42 believer who wasn't able to join us, Mamoru Hosoda, the last time one of his films was in theaters, it was Wolf Children. It was a couple years ago, and we kind of started hanging out because of Mamoru Hosoda.
Because of Wolf Children. That is absolutely true. That's where we met Sarah. I mean, we had met you before, but like,
right. It was like our first bro date.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And it's crazy because had I not posted about Wolf Children and this specific screening at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, Sarah would never have heard about it and never would have attended.
That's right. Yeah, because you tumbled in it. It was tumbling of tumble things. Yeah.
Yes. But now Hosoda is back. Brand new movie, The Boy and the Beast. And it focuses on a kid named Ren who recently lost his mother, and he doesn't know where his father is, and he finds himself fleeing from the rest of his family because it feels like he just doesn't have a sort of a connection with them.
Yeah, because of reasons.
Because of reasons.
Like, it's very odd how they don't really get into the specifics of it, but I feel like that the whole reason for it is just he's just mad at life at the time. So he's not willing to work with his family members.
Well,
you know?
Not only that, but they kind of seemed like bourgeoisie and they kind of were looking down on him. Because I think his mother came from a rich family and his dad was poor and a plebeian. And and then they got divorced and it didn't go well. So he was just kind of like this black sheep child of a dead mother and a divorced father.
Sad.
Yeah, so I mean that's a really good reason to be mad and not want to, you know, hang out with your family.
Right. And you see this sort of thing happen to him. Like, he's got this sort of darkness that is within him. And at first you think, oh, this is sort of like something that's hard to really explain, but it winds up becoming a much bigger metaphor for not just him but for other characters later on.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it's it was very good imagery, the way that they put all that together with the darkness within and everything.
We won't spoil it or spoil anything about it. But
yeah, I really don't want to spoil it, but it's one of those things where when you watch the film, you start putting two and two together and you see all the other characters who also have this little bit of darkness in them. You get a realization of what it symbolizes.
Right, yeah.
So later on, he runs into Kumatetsu, who's like this.
Who actually runs into him.
Oh, yes. Yes, he runs into him. And Kumatetsu decides to take him on as his disciple in the Beast Kingdom.
I like that all the Beast characters, like Kumatetsu has, you know, Kuma in his name, which means bear.
Yeah.
And the other guy was Io something, like the Kumatetsu's disciple was what?
Iozen.
Yeah, Iozen. And Io is, I believe, boar, or Ino specifically is boar. But that's how it kind of goes. So, like, they kind of put, like, the beast name like the actual animal that they are matched with like something Japanese afterwards.
Yeah. Although it kind of felt for me like Kumatetsu was kind of like this creature in the same way that they described Chowder from the Cartoon Network show. Yeah. Chowder, this bear, cat, rabbit thing.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah.
Well, he is kind of a mixture of like the bear and human form and all that fun stuff. Everybody, it's what's the phrase? Anthropomorphic.
Yeah, anthropomorphic.
Anthropomorphic.
Do you think Mamoru Hosoda is a furry?
What if you know? I read an interview where someone asked him that, and he just responded with a smile.
Oh, really? Because
I'm not judging. It's cool.
Yeah, because you know he made a well. I mean, he has furry characters in Summer Wars, mm-hmm. and he has. Furry characters in Wolf Children, and yep. he has furry characters in Boy and the Beast.
Yeah.
And he did the Digimon movie. He's like, Digimon's awesome. You know, I'm going to do the Digimon movie. So maybe Momos is a furry.
No, judgment. Hey, yeah, at least it turns out, if it makes a great story, then go for it.
Yeah, but I mean, there were no furry characters in The Girl Who Lived Through Time, so who knows, that threw it off. That, which, you know, as I keep mentioning, you know, Girl Who Lived Through Time and Summer Wars have a constant battle of fighting over which one's my favorite of his, but I think it's still The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, only because it holds a special place in my heart as the first one I saw.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, that was the first one I saw as well too, and I'm kind of like on the fence. I don't know if I want to call, because I love The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, I love Summer Wars, I love Wolf Children. I'm like, I want to lean towards like Wolf Children as my favorite of host of this, because I feel it's like the most emotional.
Right,
that's very true. But it was harder for me to connect with Wolf Children because we haven't had the same relationships within our families, you know, that was able to connect on those same notes. So I will say that Summer Wars was my favorite.
Yeah, our family dynamic relates more to the Summer Wars family
yes.
than the Wolf Children family.
That's very true.
Kind of the same with me, but I feel like Wolf Children, in my personal opinion, told the much better story.
Yeah, Wolf Children, the interesting thing that I said about Wolf Children was it makes the viewer want to be a mother. And because I don't have the ability to be a mother, I can't really 100% connect.
Well, what about wanting to be just a parent in general?
Wolf Children was much more about the relationships between mothers and children, specifically. I don't know if Mamoru pulled from, you know, relationship that he had with his mother or how that worked out, but it was really well told.
Well, with Hosoda, he said that the movie Wolf Children was inspired by him and his own wife trying to have a kid.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And with this movie, The Boy and the Beast, it was based on Hosoda not growing up with a father figure in his life.
Yeah. And that was and that was the reason, actually, he took that reason from Wolf Children to start developing The Boy and the Beast. Mm-hmm. And word is now that he's taken an element from The Boy and the Beast to start. He's immediately started working on a new project right now.
Yeah, I read that too. So hypothetically, what do you think it is that he took out of The Boy and the Beast and is going to put into the next movie?
So he killed the father in Wolf Children. So there was no father figure.
Yeah.
And then he made Boy and the Beast that's all about a father figure. Maybe it's
about adoption.
Yeah, maybe it's about adoption, or maybe his next one will be about maybe a husband and wife who can't have a child.
Yeah.
Who knows? Yeah. That's going to be tough, because if he's taken elements from the stories that he's writing, it'll be really interesting to see what it develops into.
Here's the thing that I want to see out of his next movie, though, which is going to be kind of weird because there's a little bit of a fantastical element to all of his movies. Or actually, sorry, there's 100% fantastical element to all of his movies.
Oh, yeah.
Besides the fact that Summer Wars was based in a computer system that can totally exist.
Which also had adoption in it.
Which did.
Yeah.
The thing I want to see him go back to, which he didn't do in Boy and the Beast, was I want him to stick to humans.
Yes.
Whereas there were, you know, werewolves in Wolf Children, but they were all at the heart still human. You know, everybody was human. They interacted with the humans on the countryside. All the kids in the classrooms were humans, and the children were trying to still figure out how to be children when they live a secluded life. Like, they didn't have to be wolves to be secluded and have those reactions that they did. That was just an element that they were hiding. So it was still human at its heart. And I think that The Boy and the Beast, with all these fantastical creatures that were the main focus, kind of took away some of the emotional element that all of his other movies had. I personally, despite the fact that Mamoru Hosoda took this movie from his most deepest, you know, thing with his father, his own emotions, this was the hardest movie for me to level with him on.
Yeah.
I didn't connect with him, with any of the characters emotionally, yeah, because they weren't real.
I did not. I not only did I not, like, tear up and cry at this movie, like I did, admittedly, with
to
all the
every single
well, actually, except for Wolf Children. Like, I didn't really cry that
oh,
much.
Oh, really? I cried during Wolf Children.
No, I didn't cry Wolf Children, but I felt like I wanted to. Like, I was just like, I was so actually disappointed in myself. I was like, I want to cry at this, but why am I not crying? Anyway, one, like, not only did I not cry at Boy and the Beast, I also felt like there was no reason for me to.
Right.
No. Well, I feel like with The Boy and the Beast, despite the fact that it had that sort of theme to it, the lack of the true father figure, I felt like Hosoda just wanted to kind of have fun with this movie rather than make it a super serious sort of thing, because he's been super serious the last couple films.
Yeah, but to that point, I will say that the movie was good, and I'm gonna leave it at the movie was, you know, good.
Yes.
But it does sink to my least favorite of all of his movies. It doesn't mean it's a bad movie. It's just that all of his other movies were so much greater, you know?
And I can understand. It's like saying that it's not his worst. It's his least greatest.
Yeah.
But it's still not saying a bad movie.
Yeah, because, you know, I felt like some of the characters had a little bit trouble, like, believing the connections that they had with one another. Some of the characters were in and out really quickly and really fast. You know, it's like relationships developed where you're like, yeah, okay. But then you didn't feel the emotional connection the same way. Like, it's like, well, okay, they are tied together, but why are they tied together?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you have the ending scene. I'm not going to spoil anything, but you watch the ending scene and you're like, is that really necessary? Like, that was too much. Where,
you're talking about the final showdown.
Yeah, so, like, I really feel like the final showdown of the movie could have taken place in one scene instead of, like, taking place and being like, we're gonna go all around Shibuya, like, everywhere. We're just going, oh wait, Shibuya?
Yes, Shibuya.
Yeah. Shibuya. That's where the crossing is, right?
Yes.
Anyway, where they met up in the little alleyway outside, the whole final confrontation should have just taken place in that entire small marketplace that they were in.
Yeah.
Like, they should not have gone anywhere else. It should have been the entire thing in that place. And that kind of emotion would have been... I mean, it was the same thing with, you know, Star Wars Episode 3.
The difference between Episode 3 and Episode 6.
Yeah. You know, so you have, like, this incredibly... In Episode 6, this incredibly emotional fight scene between Vader and Luke Skywalker, and all they do is stay in one room and get angry with one another.
Yeah, they never leave the Emperor's
and
throne room.
You feel the pain, and you feel the anger, and then you feel the realization, and then the redemption. And then, but, you know, you go to Star Wars Episode 3, and they're on robots, and they're flying around a lava planet, and then they're on a fiery hill. And then
the fight scene's 15 minutes long.
And they're climbing up a tower, and they're lightsaber battling on a tower, and you're just like, what is the point of this?
It just goes on and on and on.
And that's kind of how I felt about the final showdown in Boy and the Beast, where I was just like, no, all the emotion is...
Let's get something straight, though. It's not Star Wars Episode 3.
No.
No. Boy and the Beast is still way, way better than...
It's just a good comparison to how you do a good fight scene versus a convoluted fight scene.
Right. And I think that was one of the flaws in the movie.
Too. Yeah, absolutely.
A little bit, but I will say I did love the imagery of, like, the whale shadow going from place to place to place as it was destroying everything.
See, that's where I disagree with you. I just thought, like, I was like, really? Like, the whale? Like, why?
It's the reference to Moby Dick.
Yeah, I loved the homage to Moby Dick that was throughout the entirety of the film. But they didn't need a literal whale.
They didn't need a literal whale. And the thing is, too, is the character that causes the confrontation has no ties to Moby Dick. He just finds the book and he goes, oh, a whale. And it doesn't mean anything to him. where it may mean something to the other characters because of all the homages through the entire movie.
Yeah.
And you know, them reading the book. But that specific character does not have a tie to it.
How do we even know that he knows what a whale is?
That's right, yeah, because he's from a...
Because he's from a different universe. So.
Well, there may be a reason, but I don't want to spoil people who want to still go and see the film for
Which
the
should.
Reason why
you
he...
should absolutely.
Yeah, you should still go see the film
here's
and make your own opinion of it, always.
Yeah, here's something that I loved about the movie, though. I think this was Mamoru Hosoda's best animated film. It was animated beautifully. From the opening scene, when all the characters were silhouetted in fire, and they were doing kung fu and swordsman play and stuff like that. Oh, it was so good.
Agreed.
And the fight scenes were so good.
Yeah, they were animated so well. And the characters, their personalities were beautiful, like in their reactions and their timing and their everything was so well done.
The training sequences between Kumatetsu and Ren, or Kyuta, if you want to call him that, throughout the rest of the movie. Just watching them train, whether it's them face-to-face or it's Kyuta trying to imitate Kumatetsu when he's not looking.
Yeah. Yep.
Just was just so amazingly fun to watch.
And another thing is that was really nice is there was a little bit of a romantic aspect to it. But Mamoru knew that that was not the point of the movie. So he kind of hinted at it, like, this is something that might happen later. But it's not this movie. It's not going to happen in this movie. I'm going to dial it back. I'm going to hint at this kind of stuff. And you're going to watch the story about Ren. Like, you know, this girl gets involved, but she doesn't get romantically involved right away. It's really nice.
Yeah, it's not like a Hollywood sort of thing where the girl comes in, oh, they must fall in love and kissy-kissy and get married at the end.
Yeah, now kiss. That's Hollywood's biggest sin is the now kiss scene.
Which is the thing that they did for when we interviewed Travis Beecham.
Yeah, with the Nerdy Show.
That's what we talked about. What he talked about.
Between Mako and...
Yeah, Mako and... And Charlie Hunnam.
Yeah, Charlie Hunnam's character.
They you can tell that they like each other, but they never kiss, you know?
Travis actually said in that interview was, you know, you have them floating out in the middle of the ocean and you do not, you absolutely do not give them that scene of, well, I guess we kiss now.
Yeah.
Like, right. Just don't do that.
Yep. Yeah, you still know they like each other. They don't have to kiss in order to know that, but that's just a Hollywood thing that they do. And and Mamoru Hosoda read that perfectly.
Yeah, he did it beautifully. So
it was actually one of the more humanistic parts of Pacific Rim, the fact that they did not kiss, because they went for something more realistic, despite the fact that being like a sci-fi futuristic sort of thing with giant kaiju and monsters and robots.
So in comparison to Boy and the Beast, that romantic aspect was done incredibly well, and it wasn't overtaking the overarching story.
It wasn't fake, because then you get something like Green Lantern.
Yes.
Yo, God! let's not speak of Green Lantern.
I just did.
Yeah.
But one of the things I did like about the movie is it wasn't just about Kumatetsu training Ren. It was also about Ren training Kumatetsu to being a better individual. I'm hesitant to say the word person because that's the wrong word to use for Kumatetsu.
But a figurative person. He's
a figurative person. He's a man bear.
Yeah.
bear, rabbit, cat.
Yeah. So you start to those were the relationship that really developed well in the movies, but and there is a time skip in this movie. So you have a long time skip, and you know he gets older, but I feel like because they did that, the story felt a little rushed. Like they didn't show you anything in between. You know, like the story was there and maybe you didn't need to see those in between pieces. But then all of a sudden, all the characters had these deeper, developed relationships with one another.
And we missed it.
Yeah, and we missed it. We missed them growing together and becoming friends.
Right.
Like, you know, kids who, you know, didn't get along so well. And then they hint at, you know, they do get along really well.
And in the case of one of the characters, it's kind of the opposite of what happens, too.
Yeah, it's really pretty interesting.
I mean, there is the manga adaptation that is coming out very soon here in America. I mean, there is always a chance that they might explain that in the manga format.
Yeah,
That's very true.
Jonathan has all the manga adaptions.
I have all of Mamoru Hosoda's manga adaptions, and there's always something a little bit extra. Like, not something that changes the story completely, but just a little something that changes the dynamic just a little bit, and it works every time.
Yeah.
Now, one of the other questions I had was, because we talked a little bit about this, but did you feel like there was a bit of a rush of a need of a real antagonist in The Boy and the Beast?
Kinda. I think that was less of a problem, because I could understand when the antagonist showed up. I understood that. I felt it a little bit. Because we understood the antagonist's journey through the whole thing.
Yeah.
And of course, what's said is the best antagonist is the one who thinks he's a protagonist, which is which was this in the case.
That is true, but my concern was that it just came out of nowhere in some cases. I mean, it's a tiny bit hinted at, but you would never expect this character to do what he did.
See, and that's what I mean. That's actually what I was kind of touching on. There's that huge time skip, and you don't see any hint of that kind of relationship development. But this one I understood, though, because it was time-based. The antagonist needed to sit on it and think about it. And within the 9-year time jump that they did, you don't see anything from him because he's sitting on it and thinking about it. And that darkness inside of him is growing because he's not letting anything out. That's where the antagonist comes from. And regardless of whether or not you see him sitting on it and thinking about it for an amount of time, you know that it happened while those 9 years were passing.
Okay, I can kind of understand that as well. I mean, it kind of reminds me of Star Wars Episode 7 with the character of Kylo Ren, whereas in his case, it was maybe the opposite. Him holding in the lightness within the darkness that he had.
Yep, right.
Let me ask, if you had to rate The Boy and the Beast between 0 and 5, how would you rate it?
Ooh, that's a really tough question. Probably about a 3.5. Yeah, I think that I would have to go a 3.5. It was not the best. It was great, but it was not the best.
You see, I think I'm going to go more for a 4, because when I look at, like, all the other movies that he's done, Wolf Children, Summer Wars, and Girl Left Her Time, those are just straight down the line 5-star movies in my honest opinion.
Yeah, yep.
But this one, 4 stars out of 5 for me. It is the least greatest that Mamoru Hosoda has done, but it's nowhere near saying it's bad. It's a good, good movie.
If there's any, like I said earlier, if there's anything technical, like if you like technical aspects of animated movies, this is definitely a movie for it.
Yeah, so, like, I would say, you know, my list would be definitely Girl Who Left Through Time as a 5-star movie for me.
Summer Wars is 5.
So Summer Wars is 5.
Wolf Children's 4.
Yeah, Wolf Children's probably like 4, 4.5, and
3.5.
Yeah, 3.5 for Boy and the Beast.
Ooh, those are actually some very fair grades to give for a film like this. I mean, if you were to compare Hosoda right now to where, you know, Miyazaki was maybe at around his time as well, you might see a little bit of a comparison between how his films are rated compared to what he did towards the end of his like career.
That's true. That is very true.
Right.
But the other thing is too, is that I've come across people who have said that Boy and the Beast is his best film. Like there are people out there who think that this film is the best. They would give it 5 stars. And I don't know whether or not that's just kind of like a thing that they can't look at it objectively because it's Mamoru Hosoda.
Right. You see, for me, it's like saying, oh, this is Mamoru Hosoda at his best. Mamoru Hosoda is at his best. It's this Boy and the Beast. While it's not the best anime film, I will say that Mamoru Hosoda, whatever he does, he will always be at his best form.
Yeah. He creates masterpieces. He's a master of his craft. He understands things on a different level than even people like Miyazaki can, I would say.
And I couldn't agree more with you, because I feel like with Hosoda, because, you know, with Miyazaki, he kind of like, I wouldn't say he pushed himself away from like his personal life and his family and such, but you don't get like a true human emotional attachment to a Miyazaki film the same way that you would with a Mamoru Hosoda movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hopefully, by the time you hear this, because recording on Sunday, hopefully when this episode goes up on Tuesday, hopefully this movie is still in theaters. I think it's still in theaters. Is it still playing it in our local theater areas?
You know, I really don't know. I really don't.
I might have to double check that. But anyways, if you hear this and are interested, still interested in seeing The Boy and the Beast, it is in theaters. I'm going to guess summer Blu-ray release or even early fall Blu-ray release.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
All right.
I will be getting it. I'll be getting it. I'll be adding it to my collection.
Oh, yeah. I'm absolutely buying it as well. Yeah,
I need the whole collection, that's for sure, because he is my favorite director regardless.
Yep, and yeah. I will be buying the manga when that comes out.
Yeah, I'm the same way with, it's like with Miyazaki. Even though I did not like The Wind Rises as much as his other films, I still bought it because I wanted to complete the collection.
Yep.
All right. Andrew, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining here on No Borders, No Race. And I think we are just about out of time for this week's episode. So, Andrew, Jonathan, do your beautiful promo stuff first.
Sure. If you guys would like to join in, maybe you're going to send your opinion over to our show, you can email us at wickedanimereviews@gmail.com. That's wickedanimereviews, all one word, @gmail.com. You can also find us at facebook.com/wickedanime, where we post news and updates and, you know, even the link to Evan's podcast when it comes out.
Yep.
Because we're on it.
Yeah, we, when our latest episode comes out, which is going to be Con Month Episode 2, that Evan is on.
That is on Thursday.
Yeah.
Yay.
We'll have a link to this episode that you're listening to right now on it.
Yep. And if you guys also want to find us at nerdyshow.com/wickedanime, you can listen to our podcast right over there if you're not listening to it at soundcloud.com/wickedanime or on iTunes. You can find us on iTunes as well.
And cool. Also now Audio Boom.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Audio Boom. That's new to me. Anyway, you heard it here first on, No Borders, No Race. And you can find our videos on nerdyshow.com, but you can also find our videos over at youtube.com/wickedanimereviews. The main hub of Wicked Anime.
Mm-hmm.
You can also find us at fun places over the internet. You can find us at tumblr.com, at wickedanime.tumblr.com, where we just tumble things, random cute whatevers and funny stuff that we find.
Gross.
You can tweet at us at @YoWickedAnime. Send us a tweet. Tweet, tweet.
And we will very soon be tweeting our adventures through Anime Boston.
That's right. Find out what kind of sandwiches we like to eat.
There I don't think you're going to be able to do that because of the food court being closed.
No, yeah, the food court is closed.
StarfCon 2016!
You can look at my pictures of bagels with peanut butter.
That's right, all weekend. And finally, you can follow us over at Twitch at Wicked Anaplay. We have a Twitch channel, Wicked Anaplay, all one word.
Slow going.
It's very slow going at the moment. We're still building the library, but hopefully, when we have time, we'll be able to do that, and you'll get to see highlights over on the YouTube channel, because that would be really fun, I think. But that's all we got.
No, that's not all you got. Please tell our listeners where they can find you at Anime Boston this year.
Hey, guys, guess what? In a couple weeks, Anime Boston's coming around. That's why we're doing Con Month over at our podcast.
Yeah, Anime Boston is March 25th to the 27th.
Yep, but we will be there from the 24th to the 27th. So if you guys are there on Thursday for pre-registration, you can find us. Anyway, if you guys also want to check us out on Saturday, you will be able, at Saturday at 5:30 specifically, you will be able to see My Waifu's Not Weird, which is a bigger panel room than we had last year, so
I still think we're going to max it out.
Max it out for this because it got huge hype last year.
Waifu Riot! Waifu Riot!
I'm kind of hoping that that's going to be going down in infamy. That'll be awesome.
it still happened again.
I know. That'd be so great. It would be so great. I lost my train of thought. So we have Waifu at 5:30, and it will go on for an hour, but I think next year we're going to have to pull it for an hour and a half.
Yeah, because we have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, we do. And I think they'll give it to us as a thing.
Probably.
So, and then at... technically, it's going to be on Sunday morning, but Saturday night at 1 a.m. It's not technically Sunday until you fall asleep and wake up.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? We all agree.
That's how it works.
Yeah. So Saturday night / Sunday morning at 1 a.m. in the morning, you are going to be able...
That's redundant.
Yeah, you can find... you can find us at the Hardcore Anime Panel. It's the last show of the con of all Saturday.
That is the hardcore Wicked Anime presents the Hardcore Anime Fest. This is the fourth year we're going to be running it.
Yeah, and they give us a really big room.
And not only is it a really big room, but it's a really good show this year too.
We it is. I promise you, it is going to be the best show that we have ever put on.
And by really big room, we mean up to 1,000 people can fit in this room.
Yep.
And listeners, key advice, make sure you drink lots of coffee to stay up to enjoy the Hardcore Anime Panel. I'm not saying it's going to be boring, because it is not boring. It will not make you fall asleep. It'll give you plenty of nightmares afterwards, no doubt, but...
actually do have a lot more horror this time around, too, and I'm kind of afraid where that's going to go.
Yeah. Oh, that's going to be fun. It's going to be fun, I can guarantee you.
We also have more baseball bats.
Yes.
What? And that's not just because it's the sports year.
Yeah, no, right.
Oh,
the sports team.
But it could be. It could be, you know.
Yeah.
Yes. All right. So for our listeners, for the recent news, reviews, podcast episodes, and videos featuring members of the Boston Bash Brigade, you can find us at www.b3crew.com. If you have any questions, comments, if you're in a band and want to be featured on the show, or if you have any questions for our friend Sawa Sensei, you can write to us at thebastards@bostonbashbrigade.com. You can find me on Tumblr at b3crew.tumblr.com, on Twitter at king_baby_duck, on Twitch at twitch.tv/omnistryinc, and on Anime Amino at kingbabyduckesh. Like us on facebook.com/bostonbashbrigade and on facebook.com/landofesh. And for all the other sites under the Land of Esh, please be sure to go and visit The Electric Sisterhood, Phil's Recap and Review, Smashed Rook, The Structure Network, and Nerd Crave. And I'll be there at Anime Boston. Andrew Jonathan will be there at Anime Boston. Nerd Crave's going to be there at Anime Boston. There's going to be a lot of good people that you're going to be able to say hi to.
Manga Gamer's going to be at Anime Boston.
Oh, Sarah, yeah.
42's Anime Review's going to be at Anime Boston. IamThink.com is going to be at Anime Boston.
Yeah.
It's going to be a party.
It's going to be a party.
A party!
Yeah.
So, for this episode, we're going to end the show with the end theme to The Boy and the Beast.
I really like that song.
Yeah, yes. It was good.
Yeah, performed by Mr. Children, and from last year's Reflection album, this song is called Starting Over. And until next time, this is King Baby Duck.
Andrew from Wicked Anime.
Jonathan from Wicked Anime.
Reminding you that you don't have to be from Boston to be a bastard. But it sure helps.
All right, I'm going to go play Fire Emblem now.
Monster の目の奥に孤独と実在を見つけ捨てられた子猫みたいに体を丸め
Hey guys, this is Evan Borgo from the Electric Sisterhood and host of the No Borders, No Race podcast. What you hear each week on our show is but a mere taste of what you can expect from these talented artists from Japan, America, Europe, and the rest of the world. So if you enjoyed something from this week's selections, go to cdjapan.co.jp, amazon.com, iTunes, Bandcamp, the band's official sites, or your local record store to help give these artists your support. We always give our readers and listeners the links to the albums from the respective songs we've spun. So if something resonated with you, give that album name a click and get that record in your possession. Who knows? That one album purchase may help to bring your favorite J-pop artist one step closer to your town. So until next time, keep your volume dimed out and remember to spread the Japanese music revolution wherever your roads take you.